This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, January 6th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
Are you thinking about quitting your job right now? A lot of us are, so let's talk about this, the great resignation.
This is it. A lot of us. My last day teaching. I just put in my resignation.
If you had asked me in the summer if I would be part of the great resignation, I would say absolutely not. But now?
I was very clear and open with them when I quit that I was quitting to focus on my mental health and explore my interests and see where things take me.
Okay, everybody, the official return to office date is July 15th. Finally. Oh, you're excited. Oh no, I quit.
For months, social media has been inundated with posts like these. People announcing and often celebrating their decisions to leave their jobs.
What? Right at our job, right? Somebody said, hey, don't schedule me on Mondays. And guess what they did? Scheduled him on Monday. And guess what happened? He's not working Mondays anymore because he quit expeditiously. He sent me a SpongeBob meme that says, I don't really feel like it. That's the workplace nowadays. Respect your workers, please.
This week, the U.S. Labor Department reported that 4.5 million people left their jobs in November. The most since the government began collecting data 2 decades ago. A major reason for this so-called great resignation is the COVID-19 pandemic, which has changed the relationship between office workers and their workplaces and exacerbated challenges faced by workers in health, hospitality, education, and other sectors. Some also argue that the Great Resignation is part of a larger movement against employers who ask more and more of their employees while providing less in terms of work satisfaction. Cal Newport, a New Yorker contributing writer who writes the Office Space column for NewYorker.com, joins me to discuss the Great Resignation, the future of work across professions, and how employees and managers can ease burnout. Hi, Cal. Happy New Year, and thanks for joining me.
Well, Dorothy, Happy New Year to you as well, and it's my pleasure.
I think we should start by defining some terms here, because the U.S. workforce obviously is not a monolith. When you write about office life and corporate culture, you use the term knowledge workers. Whom do you include in that group?
Roughly speaking, I'm talking about what we can think of as computer screen and email workers. So if you spend most of your day in front of a computer screen and send and receive a non-trivial number of emails, that's the slice that I mainly focus on. Knowledge worker captures that roughly, but knowledge worker does have a lot of varying definitions. So that's how I try to hone it in. Computer screens and emails. You're in an office. You probably were working remotely during large parts of the pandemic. That's the group I've been focusing on.
So tell us a little bit about what employment trends we've seen in this arena over the last few months.
Well, there's definitely been some confusion in some of the popular takes on what's going on with the Great Resignation, because as you mentioned, there is a lot of different facets to what's going on here. There's different sectors that are contributing different aspects to the Great Resignation itself. And so what seems to be going on is that in the computer screen and email worker, knowledge worker segment, we're seeing not necessarily a large increase in quitting. This seems to be coming in other sectors of the economy, but we are seeing a very clear signal about burnout or exhaustion about work. That is really rising in particular among that group. This is also the group that had probably the biggest change to their work environment during the pandemic, because it's a group that moved largely remote. And depending on where you live, you may even still be remote now or not. So they're burnt out and they're working remotely. They're not yet quitting at the same rate as in other sectors like hospitality or service, but they're not happy.
So let's talk about the changes that lower wage workers are demanding, particularly in the service industries, where there's been, it seems, a considerable supply and demand discrepancy. What is going on there?
Well, if we look in the service industries, there is certainly more leverage that has been given to the worker because of that supply and demand issue, which is allowing progress to be made on certain labor standards that would probably had stagnated before. So progress on wages, progress on working conditions. I think certainly during the pre-vaccine stage of the pandemic, there was a real concern and pushback among that sector of the economy about the safety of their situations. So I think in the wage-based service sectors, that leverage is pushing towards a lot of what we can think of as almost classic labor reforms.
Yeah, and belatedly, I might add. And we're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that starting January 1st, 26 states plan to raise the minimum wage, although the highest is still $15 an hour in California and parts of New York.
And that's become temporarily moot in the sense that much higher than that is having to be offered in a lot of these jobs to get people to actually come and take the slots. But I think it's a smart move on behalf of the labor movements to codify that into the law, because the supply and demand equation is going to rebalance as we move farther away from the acute disruptions of the pandemic. And that will then, they're taking advantage of this moment to codify into the perpetuity the higher wages, which is a smart political move, I think, from those who are making these arguments right now.
Yeah, and bringing attention to the grossly underpaid health services, for one thing, the workers who have been going to their jobs every single day throughout the pandemic, not to mention, you know, all of the disruptions for teachers, you know, and these are professions that have been historically just terribly underpaid and underappreciated.
Yeah, well, we're certainly seeing that in healthcare. That is hard to miss, the strain that those workers are under, as well as the very large wages that are available for those who are working freelance, who are working shift work. We also saw this in the airline industry. Some airlines right now are offering up to triple pay to get pilots to come back and fly for them. So there's a lot of really extreme things happening right now in the labor markets.
And maybe we should back up a little, going back to corporate culture, and talk about the pressures it's been under for a long time. Could you talk a little bit about why?
So the corporate world is interesting. I mean, especially if we're going to focus in on the workers who work in corporate office environments. And this is an interesting thread to pull, because there's an instinct, I think, to apply some of the thinking that accurately applies to what we were just talking about. Let's say you're in the service industry and we're talking about work hours and we're talking about wages, or if we're looking in the industrial sector, the reforms that have been happening in warehouse work, Amazon warehouse workers, et cetera, unionization efforts, et cetera. It's easy to try to graph that onto what's happening within offices and office workers, because they're also burning out. But the dynamics here are very different. The thing I seem to be uncovering in my reporting on office worker burnout, I think, is not coming as much from an exploitative manager worker dyad, where this side is trying to exploit this side and this side has to try to fight back. What I think has been happening also in this office work sector is that there is a lot of weakness in the way we did this work, a lot of haphazardness, a lot of non-systematically or systemic thinking about how this office work should unfold. We've been basically winging it ever since the advent of computers and computer networks. And when this was put under stress by the disruption of the pandemic, it spiraled out of control. And we ended up in these situations where workers are in Zoom meetings for 8 hours a day or answering emails once every 2 minutes. And this is less about this gets us more value out of the worker, because it actually makes office workers terribly unproductive, and more about we haven't thought enough about how this type of work should happen, and therefore we weren't able to pivot to deal with the disruption of the pandemic. So we're at a moment now where we realize office work itself is going to need some fundamental reform, but maybe not in the way that some people are thinking.
Yeah, and as you've mentioned in one of your pieces, before the pandemic, corporate America was still following the classic factory model, and which wasn't really applicable anyway. And there was no reason to be working 9-to-5 factory hours in most of these companies. But just going on in terms of thinking about potential solutions, in a piece for NewYorker.com this week, you wrote about the concepts of slow work and slow productivity. Could you first tell us a little bit about slow work and the work of the writer who coined the term, Carl Honoré?
Right. Yeah. So slow work we can think of as a industrial era solution to labor issues. So slow work, roughly speaking, we can use to categorize movements to reduce the number of hours that you actually work. in the world of office work, there's been moments where this has been bigger, more in Europe than in the US. And it's entered the scene again recently, where we have the, there's a bill before Congress right now that's been sponsored by the full progressive congressional caucus that would move the federally recognized work week to only 4 days, which would have a big impact on office workers and how much they might be expected to work. That's basically slow work. And I say it's an industrial age solution because it comes out of a world where there's very little autonomy for the worker. I mean, you are basically told this is what you do. You add steering wheels to the Model Ts or what have you. And so the main lever you had was there's work condition levers. This was the first lever to be pulled. This was, you know, pre-20th century. The factory shouldn't be dark and hot, and we shouldn't have four-year-olds working on the lines. And then the second lever you had to pull was how many hours do I do this work? And so slow work kind of comes out of that mindset of the thing we can control to try to make your working life better is change the number of hours you have to work.
So talking about this bill, the 32-Hour Workweek Act, presumably that would provide benefits for lower-wage workers as well. You know, hourly workers would earn more overtime, and salaried workers who would be working a four-day workweek.
Yeah, and that's important to emphasize that this bill actually deals with many different sectors of the economy, and actually the most direct beneficiaries would be those who work hourly, because it would say you have to have overtime when you work more than 32 hours. Part of the intent of the bill, however, was to try to change the standard for office workers who aren't salaried. So Mark Dacano, the author of the bill, he verified this. He actually tweeted about that New Yorker piece earlier today and verified, yes, this is one of the big things I had in mind, was even for salaried office workers, changing the culture towards a smaller work week. So I use it as an example of slow work being partially applied to the world of office work.
But the reducing the length of the work week won't cure what ails people you call the computer screen and email workers. And you published a book last year about the tyranny of email. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what your reporting there resulted in.
Yeah, so this was the punchline of that latest article was slow work is good for, again, where you have little autonomy and your time is prescribed, but for computer screen and email workers, it's not going to solve the problem, because I think the main problem for this group, for this sector, the problem that's causing the clear rising burnout signal is not work hours, but work volume. The issue is because we have very little controls, very little system or structure about how work is identified and assigned. We just rock and roll. We just grab people on Slack and say, can you do this? Can you jump on this meeting? We greatly inflate the amount of commitments, professional commitments that each worker has on their plate at any given time. And I make an argument that when that list of commitments gets too long, you have too much work you have been asked to do, regardless of how many hours you say your work week should be, it causes a lot of problems. And one problem is it stresses us out. Our brain can't handle that overload. It cannot handle having more things we committed to than it can easily imagine accomplishing. And two, coming to your point about email, each of these things we bring on our plate brings with it a fixed amount of collaborative overhead, a certain amount of emails that have to be sent, a certain amount of meetings that have to be attended. The overhead actually overwhelms your schedule, and there's no time left to actually do the work. And that's crazy making. And it really is burning a lot of people out.
And I remember before the pandemic, one day just walking down the corridor at the New Yorker and realizing how few people were on the telephone and how few people actually were talking to each other, because people in offices adjacent to each other were emailing each other instead of getting up and talking to each other. And this kind of thing, it seems to me, has become so much worse with Slack and especially Zoom. And I can't tell you how many colleagues and friends have told me that, you know, they're on Zoom, as you say, just hours and hours each day. It's not like a normal human interaction, and it's exhausting.
I mean, I began to get emails from readers during the pandemic where this got even worse, because work volumes increased during the pandemic because a lot of work had to be done to figure out how do we, for example, run a magazine when we can't all be in person, right? So there's a lot of questions like that everyone had. I would get emails from readers who said, my biggest problem right now is figuring out when to go to the bathroom during the workday. My Zoom is back to back to back to back to back to back with no break. This is an absurd situation, right? I mean, if you looked at this objectively, when historians look back at this 20 years from now, they will say, what a crazy thing. It is like an absurdist play, a satirical commentary on office work and ennui or something. I mean, it's just absurd, but we just accept it. I guess I should just be on Zoom all day doing my email and Slack while I'm on Zoom. So I'll be doing these two things concurrently. It can't possibly be the right way to take a bunch of human brains and say, hey, produce value. But it's where we've ended up. And so this is why I really think it's a mark of crisis in this particular economic sector.
And I have to ask you about one of your pieces. Last fall, the tech entrepreneur Chris Hurd talked to you about his thoughts on what he calls remote first work. And so I want you to define that to us, but also ask you, isn't the tech industry a big part of the problem here, providing more and more tools to clutter our screens and our inboxes and our brains?
You know, I think what's happening with the tech industry is two things. There's something I'll give them credit for and something that I will push back on them for. Partially, I think it's not the tool itself. In some cases, these tools are perfectly reasonable for what they do. Zoom is a perfectly reasonable tool for having a video conference. Email is a perfectly reasonable tool for sending a file or information asynchronously. It works better than voicemail. It works better than fax machines. But the issue is that we're doing so much of it. And so like one thought experiment I give is imagine if you only had one project you were working on and that was it. And it was all you had to do in your job. And maybe you use Zoom. Like, yeah, I meet with the team that I'm working on. We meet twice a week on Zoom. And maybe there's like a dozen emails we send back and forth each week. That would seem completely reasonable. You're like, this is great. The issue is when you have eight of those projects that have been put on your plate. And now you have 16 Zoom meetings you have to do, and that dozen emails becomes 96 emails. And then suddenly, I can't get any work done. So part of the issue here is not the tool, but the fact that we're in an overhead spiral. We have too much on our plate. Where I'm going to push back on the tech industry is that, and you can't blame them, I suppose, but they think the solution to these problems is with better tools. They have put the American work culture in particular into this tool-first mindset where we're convinced that everything that has to do with productivity comes down to tools. And so if we're overwhelmed and unproductive, we need better email inboxes that are going to use AI to auto-sort and prioritize messages for us. So we need very complicated work management systems that is going to put all of our work into, you know, these different color-coded categories and learn our behavior. They really have convinced us that the solution is better tools, which leaves us helpless because we don't need new tools. We need better structures to our work. And then we should look to the toolbox and say, of the things that already exist, what should we use? And so that's the issue.
And is this being discussed by corporations? We are already into what seems to be a permanent readjustment of the way we do our work. It's cheaper for companies to keep more of their employees at home. Employees have shown, as you say, that they work actually more hours than they ever did. So tell us a little bit more about this remote-first work and what you see as a potential better way to approach it.
Yeah, I think in the 5 to 10 year timescale, we're going to see large sustainable changes. In the 1 year timescale, we're going to see what's going to feel like a reversion. I wrote an article for The New Yorker early in the pandemic about remote work. This was in May of 2020. And I made two predictions. I said, A, this shift to remote haphazardly is going to really highlight how haphazard and unstructured and ad hoc our office work habits are. And it's going to make life really hard. And B, that's going to lead to reforms. We're going to say we have to be more structured about work. I was right about the first one. I was wrong about the second one. So during 2020 and 2021, we did not see major changes to the way work is structured in this sector. And I think it's in general because though it really hurt and we were really unhappy about work and burnout was really rising, it was just one of many very terrible things happening in the world. So we had basically terribleness fatigue. When you have, you know, one out of every 400 Americans dying of a pandemic, the fact that you're also really upset about your email load just feels like one of a billion things we're already upset about. And so it didn't spark reform. And this is why I think in the near future, So let's say the next year or two, as we're no longer super worried about the virus, is we're going to see a reversion back towards more and more office work. I think we're going to see very few large companies move to a fully remote status. They're going to do some sort of hybrid status where you can spend a couple days a week not in the office, which obviates many of the advantages of a remote strategy because you still have to live near the office. And then people are going to find that they're less competitive if they actually take those days. And I think in the near future, we are going to see to many, frustrating reversion back to being largely in offices and commuting, et cetera. But on the 5 to 10 year timescale, I think we're going to see significant change. And this is the Chris Hurd theory. He is basically arguing that, yes, long-term, being remote in the sense that you do not have a long-term lease on an office building. There is not a single office building where people gather. You may still gather individually or in small groups to collaborate, but you will gather in different places depending on who you're meeting with and your purpose, but there'll be no central office. He says this strategy is being mastered right now in the startup space, because there are startups that started up during the pandemic where they had to be natively remote, and they are figuring out how to do it right. They are solving the problems I talked about in that early spring New Yorker piece. As those companies expand, they are going to win in their niches because it's just cheaper. The people are going to get hired away from these companies by private equity firms who are then going to go through other sectors of the economy, bring in these experts that learned what they're learning, their craft right now, to transform other companies more effectively to being remote first. And you do this for enough years and suddenly these remote strategies will work. So basically, it's harder than we thought to effectively run remote, but people are mastering it right now. And we are going to see the fruits of that development probably in the next 5 years. That's when we're going to be able to start seeing major companies making major permanent changes to how they operate.
Right. But isn't some of that worrisome, given your argument about email and people being locked into their screens and not, you know, actually having normal discussions with colleagues? And if more and more work is being done remote, these human connections are lost, and something important is lost in the way work is done. It's just not the same for all of us to be in our little offices at home and not talking and working out problems in person with our colleagues.
Well, I agree with you on that point, that there is a lot of power to in-person. And I will say Chris Hurd's vision, he calls it remote first instead of pure remote because he thinks you do meet with people. It's just that you don't do it every day and you don't do it in a central office. This is basically what's being worked out now in the tech startup space. The native remote startups are figuring out through aggressive experimentation what works and what doesn't. So we'll see how that shakes out. Now, this may be as pessimistic, but the issue is if it ends up being much cheaper and you're much more successful with this more remote structure of working, it will probably win regardless of whether or not it's better for us. I mean, it was not better for humans to do hour-long commutes and be in cubicles. This was not better from a human psychology standpoint, but it dominated anyways because it turned out to be what was creating money. So we have to be somewhat pessimistic about that. The issue with the screens I'm not so worried about, because that's part of what they're innovating right now, is how do we get away from just emailing and doing Zoom all day? This is a big part of the innovation they're doing right now, is figuring out how to structure work more so that it is less haphazard and ad hoc and more clear and more focused and lower work volumes. And they'll solve that problem. But I share your concern. We may end up more lonely, though I will say Chris Hurd's whole point is work shouldn't be where you find friends. Like, work is going to be this thing. It's going to be more contractual, and you're going to be much more connected to where you live, because now you don't have to live in a nameless suburb so you can be near a train line to get to work. You can live in a town somewhere where you know everyone and mountain bike in the weekends. He has a pretty Pollyannish vision about where we shift our social aspects of our life.
So maybe you can help our listeners who are making New Year's resolutions still to find a better balance between work and private lives. What advice do you give?
Well, I'm a big believer in being intentional about your time. So one of the things I preach to my particular readers and listeners is giving every minute of your workday a job. So you sort of figure out, like, when am I working today? What are my hours? What do I want to do with that time? Oh, here's when I have meetings. This time is free. I'll spend that working on this article. Here's where I'm going to catch up on these tasks. Where you're really intentional. Here's what I want to do. Here's what I'm doing with my time. Here's when my workday is done. And so I'm a big believer in doing that for each day. And then for each week, looking at your whole week ahead and moving those chess pieces around on a bigger scale. Oh, I have this big thing due. Tuesday is when I should do that because I have a lot of free time then. With that type of control over your time, you get a little bit more control over work versus non-work. When I'm working, I know what I'm doing. When I'm done, I know that I'm done. And I think that clear separation between the two makes a big difference.
It depends, though, on enormous self-discipline, which is not universal.
Well, that might be true, but I guess work by definition is the application of self-discipline because it's the application of force against stasis, if we're going to be go back to the physics level of this. So all work by definition is hard. You're sort of needing the discipline application of force. This is actually not so hard, though. What I'm talking about here, the nice thing about it is that it's quite addictive to have a clear shutdown because it quells anxiety. When you know, I know what I was doing today, I had a clear shutdown, I updated my plan before I shut down, you get a bit of a release. My mind does not have to keep thinking through work. It feels really good. And there's probably the best way to get a new habit is have the new habit make you feel really good. And so I'm pretty optimistic. When people do these clear shutdowns, they get addicted to it.
Great. I will take that with me. And thank you so much for coming on, Cal.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Cal Newport is a contributing writer for The New Yorker and an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University. He's the author, most recently, of A World Without Email. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.